Today, and that's Randy Kopp versus Scott Klein and a bunch of other folks. And Mr. Kopp, we'll hear from you. Mr. McKenna, we'll hear from you.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Thomas J. McKenna. I represent the plaintiffs and the appellants here. I'd like to just give you, the Court, an overview of what I hope to cover in my time and then go into them in detail. First, I want to discuss the issue of whether the plan was mandated both in writing and in fact, and what are the implications. Second, I want to discuss the Munch-Kirschbaum presumption of prudence and should it apply on a motion to dismiss. And third, I want to discuss briefly the facts of the case and how the presumption applies here. We start, of course, that this is a case under ERISA. It's a 401k plan to help people save for their retirement. The defendants that we're going to talk about are the Benefits Committee. The Benefits Committee was appointed to administer the plan. The Benefit Committee is supposed to administer all the assets of the plan. The Benefits Committee is a named fiduciary, and with that comes all the duties under ERISA. And one of the duties the Benefit Committee was given was the duty to select and terminate investment options for plan participants. There are several ERISA standards that come to bear. The first one is 29 U.S.C. 1104, the prudent man standard. What is a fiduciary supposed to do? How is he supposed to behave? Second, under ERISA, Section 1104, a fiduciary has a duty in certain circumstances to override plan terms if following them would violate ERISA. All plans must be maintained so that there's a fiduciary in charge of the assets. The money is supposed to be held in trust, and the trustee is supposed to take his directions from the named fiduciary. And finally, 29 U.S.C. 1110 voids, as against public policy, any provision in any agreement or plan instrument that purports to relieve any fiduciary of his other duties under ERISA. So with that as the backdrop, we would talk about where the district court went astray because they followed the defendant's arguments. The first argument.
The problem in the case is kind of hard to know which hat is being worn here.
Well, I think we can answer that. And there's a very important piece of evidence in the record before Your Honors that I think answers that question. It's the unanimous written consent of the Employee Benefits Committee. Remember, they're the named fiduciary charged with protecting the assets. It's found in the record on page 1568. And 69. That document, now the defendants, remember, claim that the stock is mandated and the fiduciary has no duties whatsoever in connection with the IDARC stock fund. You have the whole plan, and the plan, the benefit committee is the fiduciary in charge of the whole plan and all the assets. And you have one of the assets, one fund, is the IDARC company stock fund. And they're trying to say, and they persuaded the district court, that under that one fund of the whole plan, there's no fiduciary in charge of that. And I say this document, which I'm citing to Your Honors, 1569, gives the lie to that, shows that that's not true, because on November 17th, 2008, during the class period, the IDARC Employee Benefits Committee prohibited plan participants from making any future investments in individual stocks.
Now,
how does that help you?
It helps me because it shows, Your Honor, that they had discretion and they acted with discretion.
All right. If they had discretion, tell me the date they should have exercised that discretion and why.
I say, Your Honor, that based on what we know now, they should have exercised the discretion.
Yeah, but you can't do that.
What? Why not? I'm sorry. What?
I mean, what we know now.
What we have alleged is that the class period starts when IDARC was spun off from Verizon and loaded up with $9 billion of debt that they could not handle, and that they then, like the clown that spins the plates, they spun the plates for 2 years till they got to the end of the tax-free write-off zone, and then they went into bankruptcy.
So you're saying that the fiduciary breached his duty the day the stock was funded by the settlor, by even administering the thing? Is that
the beginning of the class period? And all through the class period, the stock was imprudent, Your Honor. It was imprudent because this company was destined to fail. And they knew or should have known it because they manipulated the books and records. They sent out false, fictitious invoices. They had bad debts they knew they couldn't collect.
How much was the stock worth at the time that the trust was formed?
It was worth approximately $27 at the start of the class period and 3 cents at the end.
How much was it worth in July of 2000 and what would it have been? When did it close out? When did it finally liquidate?
The company went to bankruptcy in March of 2009, Your Honor.
2009?
Yes.
All right. So what was it in July of 2009?
After it was wiped out. That's after the class period, Judge.
What was it? The stock market went down in October of 2008, right?
Yes,
lost
Your Honor.
2400 points.
Generally.
So before that, like in July, before that October, about what was it worth?
I don't know it offhand, but it had steadily declined. So it was lower than 27. I believe it was in the teens, but I could submit that separately, Judge. So the reason why I was saying this helps me, and I think it gives the answer, you can't claim that the stock is mandated and you have no power to do anything if you then do something, if you act. It's like an admission against interest.
What you're saying is I understand what you're saying, is that the day the trust was funded by the settlor, that the administrator assumed that day a duty, a fiduciary duty, to amend the plan that he had all of a sudden been set, had been determined to be the administrator of. And because the administrator should have known everything that was going on.
I understand your question, Your Honor, but we've pled a fact pattern that goes on for 2 years, and it will be for the trier of fact to decide at what point in time should a reasonably prudent fiduciary acted to protect his wards. And we say that bit by bit by bit, it got worse and worse and worse.
I want you to tell me that. I mean, if you can't tell me that, you can't tell a jury when to find it.
Well, Your Honor, the Braden case in the Eighth Circuit explains the predicament that the wards find them in. The fiduciaries have all the information. We have access to almost none of it. All we've gotten is the plan documents. We don't have the minutes of the committee, the benefits committee, to find out, were they doing anything? Were they analyzing the prudence of this stock? We don't have the communications that they sent to the plan participants. We have almost nothing except what we could determine from the public record and from the confidential witnesses in the related securities case, where under a heightened pleading standard, the motion to dismiss was summarily denied, and just recently summary judgment was also denied. And we have the same facts pled in our case under Rule 8, a lower negligence standard. We were dismissed. And yet, under the fraud hire standard, that case is going to trial in June, Your Honor.
Let me ask you this question. Let's assume this company, it was not company-owned stock. It was some publicly traded stock that this company had no relation to. What the standards that you set forth seem to me to impose obligations on ERISA plan administrators outside of company-owned stock. I mean, the arguments you're making seem to me to almost make ERISA plan administrators insurers of the stocks they pick.
No, Your Honor. They're not insurers, but they have the highest duty known to the law to protect their wards. And those words either mean what they say or now they've been rendered.
So tell me how this would work. How would your legal theories work with regard to stock that is not company stock?
If they had invested, for example, in the Vanguard Mutual Fund and they knew or should have known that there was something imprudent about the Vanguard fund because there was something wrong with the investment manager or the stock that was being held was not prudent, they should terminate the Vanguard fund.
The administrator should?
The fiduciary, Judge. The benefits committee is the named fiduciary.
Right from Sam. The administrator is the one.
Okay, and so... All right, but
the fiduciary has the authority to come in and to reconfigure the trust that has been set up by the settlor who is funding the trust itself.
He does, Your Honor, because ERISA says you cannot set up a plan that wipes out the duties, all the main duties under ERISA. So if you follow the defendant's argument.
That's why the duty of prudence comes in.
Yes, and you exactly, and a prudent fiduciary has to look at all the circumstances of a similar character. This is people saving their money for retirement. This is not people taking a flyer, and you're supposed to look at all the circumstances and decide what's prudent. And if you follow, with respect, Judge, if you follow the defendant's argument, what you've done now is carved out one pot of money in the plan that there's no fiduciary in charge of.
Back to my question. Let's assume that you gave a Vanguard fund as an example. Suppose that one or more of the plan administrators had insider information about a Vanguard fund that was in their portfolio, and it's against the law to trade on that inside information. What is the plan administrator supposed to do?
They're supposed to act, Your Honor. If they
do what?
They're supposed to either terminate, they can stop new purchases, that's not trading on inside information. They can inform other people, they can release the information to the public, they can do any number of steps. And what you've posited is that when these fiduciaries voluntarily
they can release their insider information about Vanguard to the public or do what?
They can resign if they're in a conflict position. They can curtail new investments. I see my time is up, but I just wanted to
go ahead.
Thank you. What the hypothetical you posit, the evil of that fact pattern, is that these people volunteered to undertake the highest duty known to law. And if they find themselves in a conflict position where they're having trouble obeying the securities law and they're having trouble obeying the ERISA, which is the highest duty known to law, they're not supposed to just throw their wards overboard. If they're in a conflict position, that should be they should suffer the loss, not their innocent wards.
Do you have any questions?
Not right now. I'll talk to them afterwards.
Thank you, Judge Garza.
Okay.
Ms. Johnston from the Department of Labor, we'll hear from you.
Good morning. My name is Sarah Johnson, and I'm here on behalf of the Secretary of Labor. With my limited time today, I plan to make 3 points. First, that the parallel securities action brought by IDARC investors should not affect the panel's treatment of this ERISA action. Second, that a plan settler cannot hardwire a plan by mandating investment in employer stock so that no fiduciary is responsible for conforming plan conduct to ERISA's requirements. And third, that the district court incorrectly applied Kirschbaum's evidentiary presumption by applying it at the pleading stage. This case alleges that the defendants breached their fiduciary duty of prudence under ERISA. The action plaintiffs bring is not subordinate to claims brought by other investors in IDARC stock. ERISA and the securities laws are complementary statutory regimes with different legal standards and remedies. Defendants must comply with both laws. Compliance with ERISA never...
Can you in this situation?
Yes, you can.
I mean, if it's insider information... Mm-hmm. And they comply with the fiduciary obligation under ERISA, haven't they violated the securities laws?
No, Your Honor. Compliance with ERISA never requires fiduciaries to violate insider trading laws.
Well, let's just say, the pleadings in this case indicated that they had, that the benefit committee were also had other hats where they got information mm-hmm. that the underlying company was in bad shape, okay? It hadn't been disclosed. Now, can they use that information to protect the beneficiaries of the ERISA plan?
No, they cannot trade on that information to divest. You know, they can't rely on the insider information to divest the stock, but they can take other actions. They can stop future purchases. So nothing in the securities laws mandates that an insider must buy additional employer stock
so
simply because the plan says so.
They can't
right?
purchase new
they can
stock.
They can stop making new purchases of the employer stock.
But
there's
you agree they can't
the
divest.
Laws that requires them to make additional
you agree purchases. They can't divest.
They cannot divest. It's a violation of the securities laws
right.
to commit insider trading. But they can stop future purchases, and they can also... they can also disclose, so they could either disclose the information themselves to the public, not just to the participants, but to everyone, or they could go to the
now,
corporate...
But who discloses? Is it the fiduciary that discloses, or is it the the settler, the company that discloses. And see, this is, you know, same people, different responsibilities, different causes of action. And that's what I want to get behind, if you could help.
Right. So, I mean, it depends on what the overlap is in the roles. So if the fiduciaries were also the same people who would normally be responsible for making such corporate disclosures, they could do it and disclose it.
What if they're not required to disclose under securities laws?
Well, ERISA's disclosure requirements are independent of those with the securities laws. They're consistent, but could be additional. There's nothing that would.
So if you have an ERISA plan that you have your stock in, that elevates that company's SEC requirements to report, publicly report.
Well, I mean, I think that's not this. That's not this.
No,
case.
We're asking you how this works. You know.
Yeah. No. If a duty to disclose arises under ERISA,
you can't just disclose to your plan participants because that would be insider information.
That's correct.
So you're saying that if you have an ERISA plan in which your company's stock is part of an option, you have a higher standard to make public disclosures under ERISA than the SEC laws.
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
To help me sort through it.
I mean, the duty to disclose under ERISA.
I mean, whenever you make the concession that you did to Judge Owens, I mean, you've essentially conceded your case, haven't you?
Here the plaintiff's allegations are that this insider information would have needed to be disclosed under either set of rules, and so.
But just, shouldn't we wait to see what the securities law outcome is? We don't want to prejudge that. Shouldn't that be parallel with the obligations to disclose under ERISA?
The cases have somewhat different defendants, even though they involve the same conduct. There are different legal standards and remedies, and it's not a reason to stop this case from going forward.
What if we say that the district judge here would say, well, you should have disclosed this under the securities laws, and therefore it violates ERISA, and then the securities suit says, no, that wasn't, you weren't required to disclose.
So you're suggesting delaying this case?
I'm suggesting is the duty to disclose to the public, is it heightened because of ERISA as an overlay over the securities laws?
ERISA requires the disclosure of materially adverse information that could affect the plan participants, and I think that perhaps I should clarify how those two standards overlap after this argument, if that would be helpful to you. Let me go ahead and turn to the hardwiring issue, which I also think is very important. The court should reject the extreme argument that ERISA permits the plan at issue here to operate without any responsible fiduciary to conform plan conduct to statutory requirements. Someone has to be responsible. Oh, I'm sorry. I did not realize I had gone over my time. Would you like me to continue?
Keep on going.
Okay. So someone has to be responsible as a fiduciary. You can't have a plan on autopilot with no fiduciary responsible for conforming plan conduct to the statute. And under defendant's argument, the plan would be left with no one to perform that responsibility.
Has, you know, this problem here that we have has been around for a while. Has the Secretary thought of proposing legislative changes to address this particular problem that may be conflicting with the securities laws? Where a fiduciary might be faced with either violating ERISA or violating securities laws.
I'm not aware of any legislation, but I could look into that for you. On this hardwiring issue, all of the other circuits have held that you can't immunize fiduciaries by mandating investment in employer stock, and so, you know, if the Sixth Circuit in Cooper and the Second Circuit in Citigroup.
See, but do you see what you're doing to a fiduciary? You're putting them in a heck of a position. On the one hand, they're supposed to divine when, you know, the whole stock is almost worthless, and they are liable if they make the wrong decision one way or the other. It just seems to me that this is go ahead and finish. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, it is a difficulty, but I think, you know, Congress subjected fiduciaries to the duty of prudence. They did not exempt fiduciaries from the duty of prudence, even when investing in employer stock. I mean, they did exempt fiduciaries from the duty of diversification, right? You don't have a duty to diversify stock plan, but you do still have to determine as a fiduciary whether an investment is prudent.
In this situation, does the duty of prudence conflict with the non-duty of diversification?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the duty of prudence is the allegations in this case are of in addition to the financial situation.
I mean, apparently what you're saying, everything that was known really to the fiduciaries in terms of the stock going down and when they should get out and all of that was available to the really was essentially available to the participants themselves. They could see the stock was going down. They had choices to make. They could exercise their discretion about looking into and investigating the stock themselves. I mean, they had that option.
Right, but the fiduciaries still have a duty to ensure that the options that the plan offers are prudent. And the allegations in this case are not only that the stock was declining, but that the defendants had insider knowledge.
Okay, just when does the administrator assume the authority to override the settlor and change and rearrange the investments of the portfolio that is available to the beneficiaries?
Well, it's never prudent to knowingly invest in stock that's artificially inflated. So if you know that the market value of this stock is inflated due to insider information that you hold about corporate wrongdoing or misconduct, then it can't be a prudent.
Okay, then the settlor says, no, I'm not going to change. I'm not going to rearrange my investments in this trust that I have created. The administrator says, well, you should invest, you should change it. Who has the authority either to not change it or to change it?
Well, Congress said there's several provisions of ERISA that very clearly lay out yes, the fiduciary is required to follow the plan, but only insofar as it's consistent with the statute.
And you have
ERISA
a red
also
light.
Voids you, against public policy.
You have a red light.
What?
You have a red light, so.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Landau, I'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Chris Landau, and I'm here today on behalf of the defendants. I'd like to start, if I might, with the first question that Judge Jolly posed to my opposing counsel, saying, which I don't believe was answered, saying, isn't the real problem with their theory that people wear different hats under ERISA, they act in different capacities? And in these cases, it's often the same people. In this case, the Benefits Committee had functions as settlor. They had delegated authority under each of the plans at issue here to amend the plan as settlors. That's in Section 1201 of the Management Plan at App 383, Section 2001 of the Mid-Atlantic Plan at App 515, and Section 18.1 of the North Plan at App 599. Each of those specifically said that the Benefits Committee or the Chief Human Resources Officer who was a member of the Benefits Committee, Defendant Scaife, had the authority to amend the plan. And we know from the Supreme Court in Lockheed and Spink and many other cases that the act of amending a plan is inherently a settlor act. So as
I understand it, but I mean, it seems to me that whenever you put the same hat on the same person, I mean, two hats on the same person, you're confusing the roles immediately. And you just, it's hard to.
Well, Your Honor, in all of these cases, In Spink, Lockheed versus Spink, in the Hughes aircraft case, both in the Supreme Court, the same people did have both fiduciary and administrative responsibilities. You don't just look to the fact that it's the people. You look at what's the nature of the act they're performing. Here, as a matter of law, we know two things. We know first from each of the plans that the only way to remove company stock as an investment alternative was through a plan amendment. It's undisputed that each of the plans unambiguously said that. And we know that the resolution on which they based basically their entire case was adopted by the Benefits Committee that had settlor obligations and settlor authority. And so as a matter of law, this is not an issue of fact. The only legal way to do this was through a plan amendment.
Mr. Lando, Mr. McKenna said that there was a unanimous written consent to sell this particular stock, or I'm not sure exactly, but that came up in the briefs.
Yes.
I want you to touch on that. Doesn't Absolutely. That indicate authority of the Benefits Committee that were the fiduciaries that they could do what they say they can't do today?
No, Your Honor, because the Benefits Committee, under the three provisions of the plans that I just mentioned, were not only plan administrators, they were also settlors. That Benefits Committee had delegated...
So you're saying that this action that was taken, and then I guess it was reneged, or was taken back, I'm not sure, I believe that's what the briefs indicated, was taken by the Benefits Committee as settlors and not as fiduciaries.
Absolutely. And how do we know that, Your Honor? We know that because the plans themselves specified that the only way to remove company stock as an investment alternative was through a plan amendment. And we know that the very Benefits Committee that we are talking about here had delegated authority to act as a settlor in amending the plan. So it follows then that when you have this...
As a matter of law, too, you also know the duties of a settlor and the duties of a fiduciary are completely different.
Correct.
And so you assume, there's an assumption that if there's an amendment to the plan, it's by the settlor.
Absolutely, Your
Honor. But it seems to me also that you could rebut that assumption with evidence. And I don't know that there's been any evidence to indicate here that they were acting as administrator when they did it as opposed to settlor.
Well, Your Honor, again, I don't know that you could have any such evidence when the only way these are people, it's conceded that, it's clear as a matter of law from the plans, that had the authority to act as settlors, and the only way to do it was to act as settlors. I don't know how you could have a factual dispute over any other capacity. As a matter of law, the only way to do it was to do it in their capacity as a settlor.
Yeah. One other thing that Mr. McKenna said that I think is interesting, he said that this stock was, quote, destined to fail, and the fiduciaries knew it from the get-go. Now, it almost seems to me that they shouldn't even have, shouldn't even allow the plan to have this option, which again is a settlor responsibility and not a fiduciary responsibility.
Right.
Now, let's just say that it does come in like it did in this. And here's where we have the tension with the quote purpose of ERISA.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
Whatever that means.
Right. I see where you're going, Judge Garza. And the answer is, I think, as you're recognizing, their real beef here is with the plan itself, with what the settlor put into the plan, which was to have the option to invest in company stock. Let's not forget, this is not an ESOP where people are required to put any kind of investment in company stock. This is just to say it is an option. We know if we look at and there may be limits on what the settlor can do in terms of tying the administrator's hands. But we know with respect to this particular investment choice, if we look at Section 1107 of ERISA, Section 407 of ERISA, which is 29 U.S.C. 1107, that section, Congress specifically addressed this issue. I think this goes to some of Judge Owen's questions as well. Congress specifically recognized that there should be certain limitations on what a settlor can do in requiring investment in company stock. There's a 10% limit, usually, on how much of the assets of the plan can be invested in company stock. That 10% limit, however, does not apply in the context of eligible individual account plans, or IAPs. That's 29 U.S.C. 1107B. So Congress made the choice here to allow settlors to mandate that this be available as an investment option. Again, in the context of the kind of plans where employees could choose from a smorgasbord of investment options, this has to be on the table. So their whole theory here that the administrator was somehow required to override the plan, the terms of the plan, that's an extraordinary submission, and it's particularly extraordinary where Congress specifically authorized the plan to do this very thing.
How about the fact that this is at the motion to dismiss, a 12B6 motion, that is on the pleadings, as opposed to summary judgment where there's already been some discovery, or at least sufficient discovery, to move for summary judgment? Does that play anything in this case?
I don't believe it does, Your Honor.
I'm really asking the other side to think about it.
Yeah, well, you know,
I know what your answer is going to be.
Well, yeah, I don't believe it does, as you might expect me to say. But there are two theories here. There's two independent grounds for the district court's dismissal. The first one is that the plan gave the administrators no discretion with respect to allowing company stock as an option. That being the case, and that plan provision itself is legal under ERISA, under Section 1107B. Okay, so that's our fundamental submission, that you don't even have to get into presumptions and everything else. Then they have an argument. Even if we were wrong on that and they had some sliver of discretion, which we don't think they do, then there's the issue.
Well, there is the presumption of prudence. And if they overcome the presumption of prudence, then it seems to me the administrator right. does assume certain fiduciary duties.
Yeah, I misspoke if I said presumption of discretion. I'm sorry, my words got mixed up. The point is, Your Honor, you are not a fiduciary in the first place unless you have discretion. When a plan administrator who is told by the plan, you must do this and you have no discretion, is not acting in a fiduciary capacity. This is a fundamental problem with the other side's argument. They assume that an ERISA fiduciary is an all-purpose fiduciary. You're in for a penny, you're in for a pound.
What you're effectively saying is that the presumption of prudence can never be overcome, that anything the settlor decides to invest in, the administrator has no duty. No duty ever arises with respect to the administrator about the investments of the plan, however stupid.
That's correct, Your Honor. Because
so you're saying that administrator that sees that the settlor is a fool and knows that the plan is going down has no fiduciary duty to step in and do something about the fool that's running the.
Because, right, it goes back, I think the previous colloquy you had with opposing counsel recognizes essentially the way ERISA works is like a trust. The settlor sets things
what
up.
What is the presumption of prudence?
Well, Your Honor,
if the rebuttal of the presumption of prudence doesn't shift some duty to the fiduciary.
But, Your Honor, again, I think the first question, as Kirschbaum makes clear to ask, is the administrator acting as a fiduciary in the first instance?
I ask you a question, though.
Well, Your Honor, to answer your question, there is no presumption of prudence to the extent that the administrator is not acting as a fiduciary. To the extent the administrator's hands are
what
tied.
What you're saying is he never acts as a fiduciary with respect to investments.
No, with respect to investments that are mandated by the plan. Now, the plan may not be able to mandate.
But Kirschbaum, just Jones said there's two exceptions as I read Kirschbaum, and that's that the viability of a going concern was threatened, or that the stock was in danger of becoming essentially worthless.
Right.
And that kicks in the duty of prudence. And that is a duty or a responsibility of the fiduciary.
Right. With respect, Your Honor, I think there's two issues here. Kirschbaum didn't decide the threshold issue, which is if the plan mandates something, does the administrator have act as a fiduciary? Does the administrator have any fiduciary responsibilities when the administrator is straitjacketed by the plan? The plan says you must allow this investment option.
I think you're asking for too much. I think your argument here is going way overboard as to what you need to argue
to prevail in this case.
Your Honor, and I certainly don't want to do that. We can prevail on either of two grounds. We can prevail on the ground that this is a plan decision, that and this part of the plan is specifically authorized by law.
I mean, the presumption of prudence is so strong.
Okay.
That you can rely on.
Fair enough, Your Honor. Well, then this court can resolve this case just the way that this court resolved the Kirschbaum case, by saying even if there is a presumption of prudence, what is the standard for overcoming that presumption? And
even if there is, see, I mean, you.
Right.
I don't understand your argument exactly. I mean, what you you want us to overrule all cases that have referred to a presumption of prudence.
No, Your Honor, because all of those cases
can be overcome.
Your Honor, with respect, again, we're making two different arguments. All those cases.
Are you all making that argument that I just made?
Yes, but Your Honor, that is not an argument to overrule anything, because all those cases were cases where the fiduciary or the administrator acted with discretion.
It annihilates presumption of prudence, if nothing else.
Well, Your Honor, again, but that is, again, I don't want to beat a dead horse here. I just would say one thing. Excuse me?
You don't need.
Okay, fair enough. Well, again, it's true. We don't need to do that to win, because even assuming we're in the land where we are a fiduciary and you assume there is discretion, there is this presumption. This presumption as the.
And we're talking about a specific case here, too.
Correct. I agree.
So tell me here why, I mean, respond to the argument that has been made here by the plaintiff.
Yes, Your
Honor. And that is that it was a poor investment from the get-go.
Exactly.
And that the presumption of prudence can be overcome by showing that it was a foolish investment to begin with, and the administrator, with the knowledge that the administrator had, breached his fiduciary duty in not stopping that investigation at the get-go.
Your Honor, you are right, and I think some of your discussion earlier with opposing counsel really got to this. The Kirschbaum Court says when you're talking about an investment in company stock, which is a favored congressional investment, there's a heavy burden to show that allowing such an investment would be an imprudent thing to do. It's heavy burden, substantial shield.
Okay, you are. Tell me about
this
case.
Well, in this case, and I think what is so telling, the standard that Kirschbaum adopted for overcoming that presumption is that owing to circumstances not known to the settlor and not anticipated by him, the making of such investment would defeat.
I understand, and I've read all this.
Right.
I know the law. I'm asking you to try to apply the law to this case.
I think, Your Honor, your point about how their class period starts on the day this company was spun off in September of 2006 makes nonsense of that standard, because that's the day the settlor put the plan into effect. What they are saying is the whole rationale for a fiduciary or an administrator being able to override the settlor is that you that would not have been the settlor's intent to allow the company stock to be an option under these circumstances. They're saying the very day the settlor put that plan into effect, the fiduciary immediately, from one second to the other, had an immediate obligation to override that, to give effect to the settlor's intent. Their class period here, which starts again the day the plan went into effect, gives the lie to the notion that they could overcome this presumption. That's why this presumption can be applied on a.
It's virtually that's. I mean, it seems to me that it's such a almost a lethal arrow for you to shoot. I mean,
yes,
you would just shoot the presumption of innocence, presumption of
yes, and I think
prudence.
The fact kind of going back
to be overcome as I read the cases.
Excuse me?
It can hardly be overcome.
Correct. Your Honor,
strong.
If I don't need to argue anything more, you get it, and that's exactly correct. But and going back to Judge Garza's point, the fact that they ultimately went into bankruptcy can't be the standard, because they don't know at the time the stock is tanking that it ultimately is going to result in bankruptcy. Sometimes it rebounds, sometimes it doesn't. You can't, with 20/20 hindsight, say, guess what? And as you pointed out, I think.
And that's another thing. I haven't gone through the complaint in enough detail. Are the allegations known at the time they were known? Are those allegations, present allegations of what what probably they knew, you know, two or three years ago, whatever it was.
They allege that they knew the stuff at the time, but they also allege that they can overcome this presumption because of the fact that the company ultimately went into bankruptcy.
Well, they allege a lot more than that. They say on down the road that they put unrecoverable, collectible receivables on the books as assets, knowing that that was wrong.
Right.
I mean, there are lots of allegations of wrongdoing, you know, after the company was spun off, that they say was that it was never disclosed. They continued to have the stock as an option. They didn't. You know, there are lots of allegations of wrongdoing after the spinoff.
Right, Your Honor. And again, I think as some of your questions pointed out earlier, those kind of allegations are essentially securities laws violations.
Why can't they also be a violation of ERISA?
Well, Your Honor, again, to the extent that they're insisting that we had to trade on material non-public information, that would be a violation of securities laws. And their answer is, well, you could also disclose it to everybody else.
Well, if you were required to disclose it under securities laws and you did not, and then you used that and it harmed the beneficiaries of the plan, why shouldn't you be liable?
Well, Your Honor, again, the question is, there are two very different kinds of disclosures. There are corporate disclosures and there are ERISA disclosures. ERISA doesn't require you to disclose any and all facts you may know about the financial condition of the company, even if the company has some dirty laundry. In other words, I think this is a critical point, that those are corporate communications. Kirschbaum really solves this issue, because in Kirschbaum they were allegedly...
What if they had a settlor, one of the people that were acting as a settlor, to have said at the beginning, whenever they invested, this stock is going to be worthless in 10 months. And I'm telling you, we shouldn't invest in that. And they go ahead and invest in it, and they can show that you thought it was, that the settlor thought it was going to be worthless in 10 months. Does that mean that that settlor who has said that has immediately got to put on his hat as administrator and fiduciary and say, well, I'm not going to go along with this. I'm resigning.
Your Honor, again, if the administrator then had a fiduciary duty, perhaps, but under the Iqbal Twombly standard, they can't come in and just plead these kind of generic allegations that you knew things that were undisclosed. Again, that the standard for overcoming the Munch presumption, as this Court said in Kirschbaum, is that you have to show...
If Discover showed something like that...
But Your Honor, by definition there, you are saying that the settlor, the thing you have to show is due to circumstances, unforeseen circumstances, unknown to the settlor. That's the narrow window that Kirschbaum gave for people to overcome the presumption. When you're talking about things that are known to the settlor, then you might have a violation of your duties as a settlor. But that's a completely different kettle of fish.
It's not this lawsuit.
It's not this lawsuit. Absolutely not.
You were saying that the district court correctly dismissed on two grounds, and you gave us the first one. I didn't get the second
one. I'm sorry. The second one is the Munch presumption, the Kirschbaum presumption, that basically holding company stock is presumed to be prudent, and the only way to overcome that presumption is to plead facts in your complaint that would give rise to an inference that there were unforeseen circumstances that the settlor would have wanted to do something else. That whole issue about pleading versus summary judgment, it's really just an Iqbal issue. It has to be, you have to plead enough facts to give rise to a plausible entitlement to relief. That's all it is.
Okay, you have a red light there, Mr. Landau.
Thank you,
appreciate
it.
Thank you. Mr. McKenna, you have a few minutes left for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Jolly. The uniform consent that I cited Your Honors to, at a minimum, raises a question of fact that shouldn't be resolved on a motion to dismiss. Nowhere in that document does the Benefit Committee, when they prohibit future investments and implement the liquidation of the company's stock 6 weeks into the future, two discretionary acts, nowhere do they say that they were acting as a settlor subject to some directions they got from the company. Don't you think we should have a chance to put those people in the witness box and say, why did you?
Yeah, but my point to you is that what difference does it make whether they were acting as settlor or a fiduciary when they finally decided to get out of the stock?
It makes this difference.
If you can't tell me when the fiduciary duty ever arose in the first place. I assume then it arose whenever the stock market crashed in October.
It arose whenever a reasonably prudent fiduciary under like circumstances would have acted to protect his wards. It's a negligence standard. Would the driver have gone into the intersection when the light was yellow? No, he should stop. A reasonably prudent fiduciary, it's all fact-based.
When was the light yellow?
The
light was yellow at the time of investment.
I said, Your Honor, that a fact finder could find that this company was destined to fail and it was imprudent from the start. But Judge Owens correctly points out that the complaint is replete with allegations of their manipulation of the books and records throughout the class period, and that any point in time a fiduciary could have found before they drove this company into bankruptcy that the stock was imprudent. And that's for the fact finder to decide, not to be the whole case to be tried on a motion to dismiss. And Judge Garza asked, he quoted from Kirschbaum, the viability of a going concern, stock essentially worthless. That's us. That's our case. We were not a viable concern. We came in with $9 billion debt, and when we went bankrupt, it was up to $9.5 billion, and the assets were only $1.8 billion. They had five times as much debt, and they wiped out the stock in the bankruptcy, and all my clients got nothing. And then we say, so we satisfy both. And when you read Kirschbaum and it talks about Munch, we are Munch. I agree with you, Judge Jolly. If this case does not have a chance to satisfy the presumption of prudence, then there is no case. You have, the presumption now has swallowed up the prudence standard. And all you have to do is mandate the stock, claim that you tied the fiduciary's hands, and you're home free.
Well, I think the presumption of prudence should be renamed the presumption against stupidity. I mean, in other words, if you can show they're stupid, you can
give us that chance. Give us that chance, and we'll do it. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Okay. Thank you very much.